Hi there, podcast listeners. It's Anne.
This isn't a place for just anybody. I want to say you have to fit in to be here, but you have to enjoy this style of living to accept it, to become part of the river town, to become part of what goes on here.
You know, as journalists, we're all trying to do a better job these days of hearing the voices of people from parts of the country that often seem forgotten. In this case, the Mississippi River town of Hannibal, Missouri, which is documented in the new film Drifting Towards the Crescent.
I'm sure everybody in here hunts and fishes. There's not a person in here probably that isn't wielding a gun or maybe has one in their vehicle. It's hunt, fish, drink, fight. It's a river town. It's crazy. Things get crazy down here.
But I've been doing this long enough to know that you can't always capture someone perfectly just by shoving a microphone in their face. There's something like the journalistic equivalent of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle that applies. When you set out to observe something or someone, just the act of being there, your physical presence as an observer, changes things. Filmmaker Laura Stewart didn't just have microphones. She had cameras and lights and a whole film crew. That's a big distraction in a small town. So thinking about his own challenges making documentaries, Charles Monroe Kane asked her how she overcomes the uncertainty principle.
I don't know if you can. I mean, you have like your frontline docs, you know, that I think of are more like journalistic and maybe more of a pure portraits, you know, your war, even that type of footage can be tainted.
Yes.
So really, I think that it's just inherent to this art form in a sense. The minute you show up with a camera or a microphone, it is going to change the story. It is going to change who you're filming. And I'm not so sure that's necessarily a bad thing.
Right. Right. I mean, well, why? Tell me that. I'm thinking the same thing. I'm like, well, okay, maybe that's good. Maybe that
right.
gets people to open up. You could find a greater truth.
Yeah. Somebody who watched the film made an interesting comment. They were like, the characters are portraying themselves in like this manner that they really want to see themselves. Like, this is who they really want to be. It may not be who they are, but this is who they, you know, they strive to be. So, but I mean, it's just part of the game. The minute that camera rolls, you're going to get a different story.
You know, I got to take you to a scene that I found extremely uncomfortable in the film.
Okay.
And one I related to, so that gives a little bit about who I am in a minute, is it was at the, I can't call it a strip club, I guess the erotic bar where the women
the
were in
the
bikini bar. Thank you. I couldn't get the right name. They didn't take the
bikinis
off.
Bikini
it's a bikini bar. I know she explained it. Sorry. Is that in that bikini bar, one, just the music they were listening to and how they were dancing was so depressing, I almost couldn't watch it. And it just went on forever. And I was like, oh my God, please. But it was the men that I found most disturbing. I don't think they normally act like that when they're in that place. It's almost like they were performing for you out of just insecurity, the men. Did you find that? Even the way the men walked in the bar, like that they were afraid of something. They were embarrassed that they were there.
Yeah, I think you're talking about one particular scene where the guys get really rowdy.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that was unusual. Most of the time when we were filming, it'd be like two or three guys in the bar, and they'd be very quiet. This particular group came in with all this energy. You know, they'd probably had a good buzz going, so it created this totally different dynamic. But what was interesting for me watching that was to see how Liz controlled that.
She did control it. She got the she got the paddle out. I was ready for her to kick somebody's ass.
Right.
That was fantastic.
She was ready to club him over the head at any moment. So I think it showed just how she works with. And she talks about it. She says, loud's okay. You know, if I've got loud, you know, I know there's not going to be fights. She's like, I can put up with a lot, but I just don't do the fights.
Yeah, I'm curious. When I watched a scene like that, and obviously the scene stealer, even though there's this just some depression and some things that aren't that fun to watch, it is Liz. And I'm looking at Liz, and boy, she looks right in the camera with both her eyes. And I thought to myself, when you do this, what do you think you're documenting?
A lot of the characters reminded me of, they could have stepped out of the late 1800s in a sense. For me, it was about this repetition, this sense of history. And, you know, the times have changed. Okay, you know, we've got diesel barges now. The river doesn't need to stop in these towns anymore. But looking at Liz, why I wanted to document her, what I found intriguing about her was, to me, she reminded me of like this late 1800s madam.
She did. Yeah, me too. That's absolutely right. Yeah.
Yeah. And that was why I wanted to document her. And she wasn't afraid of being documented at all. She embraced it in a sense.
But I don't think she was showing off. I think we met Liz. You know what I mean? Like, she didn't need to show off. That's who she is, right?
I think that's just who she is. Yeah.
You know, we're making a living off them, quote unquote, you know, and you're showing, I think, the poorer, kind of the left outside of America. Does that ever bother you, the thought that, hey, what I'm doing is, and you're probably living a better lifestyle than them?
Well, it's very hard to make a living off these types of films. So really, for me, it's more of a labor of love. And I don't see the characters as really poor or downtrodden. To me, they're just living their lives. And I think Charlie dances because, you know, she says other people are out enjoying the river, bonfires. This is the whole summer culture here. I'd rather be making money. For her, Old Milts is where she's going to make her money. Mm-hmm. And it's just a lot of towns. You're going to work at Subway. You're going to work at Walmart. You're going to have your under $10 an hour jobs. Or you could work for someone like Liz who's going to actually care about you. You're probably going to walk out of there with a couple $100 on the weekends. And you'll meet a lot of very interesting characters.
You know, for me, I hear what you're saying, that you don't see them as down and out. And that's cool. I think that's respectful. But at the same time, I grew up very poor. And I see these men, especially, I see my uncles and cousins, and I see them. You know, I see the Harleys. I see the crappy apartments. And I see the not a lot of future. And I see these guys are one mistake or one problem away from being absolutely screwed. You know, one hand injury at the factory, one mistake here, and there's no safety net for these people. And I see people that are left behind by America, and nobody cares if they fall through those cracks. And I think some of them are going to fall through the cracks.
I think that really sums it up, that it doesn't matter if it's a Democrat or a Republican in office, that a entire area of this country has really been forgotten and left to their own devices. And it's up to your family or your friends. That's your safety net, because nobody else in Washington or the state capitol has your back.
Right.
And it's pretty terrifying when you really sit down and think about that. And I do want to state that when we wrapped our filming May a year ago, nobody was really talking about the election at that point in time. But then in summer, it started to kick into gear. And I was editing this with Zoe Sawacho, my editor. And we started talking, and it dawned on me that all the male leads in this film are employed by foreign companies. One works for a French-owned company. Another works for an Egyptian fertilizer plant. And another works for Siemens making windmills. So you look at this river, you look at this work ethic that does exist and the power of this river to move goods, and you see that where is the American investment here? And I don't really make political films, but if I were to make a political statement, that would be it. And that's at the hands of both parties.
For me, though I love Frontline and I think they do really great work and those documentaries are very important, to me, there's nothing more political than what you made. But to me, that is a political act. I mean, and I think you know
that.
I'll take
that as a compliment.
Okay, you
can
take it as a compliment. But I wanted to follow up on that with you. Like, you know that's a political act. The personal is political, and we all know that. And you know that by showing their lives the way you did, slowly and quietly showing it. To me, I think you are critiquing America. I think you are doing something political.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways, what I kept thinking about in this film is like American power. You've got the Harley, you've got the Rumble, you've got this huge dam and like how this river's controlled. And then you really look at like this holding on to this idea of American power, this American dream, and it really slipping through people's fingers and them holding on and clinging to a way of life that their families, you know, maybe their parents, their grandparents could prosper at. But in some ways, it's really elusive. You know, it is pretty scary when you just look at, you know, drive through Manitowoc, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
You look at the industry that's moved out of just all over the Midwest. And what are we going to be left with if we don't address this?
I want to change gears because I want to talk about something that I think does make sense in the sense when you're talking about politics and you're talking about some more radical things that I think you've done with a personal story, is I want to talk about beauty. With the way you used color and the way you held your shots and even the sound design, this was a beautiful film. It was beautiful.
Thank
even
you.
When it showed, you know, the front of a fertilizer factory or something run down. It just, right. You did it really beautiful. But in my sense, the overview of this is very ugly. How do you consider beauty when filming in a place like this? Women who have nowhere to go on a stripper's pole, but you made it beautiful, but at the same time, it's ugly. Like, how do you do that?
Part of what I loved about Charlie really was that she moved better than most women, you know, in that club. And I think there is a beauty in her rhythm and how she works. And I think there's a beauty in just how confident she is in her body. And she was clearly the most popular dancer in there. I have a different view of beauty, maybe. My goal is always to get the most beautiful shot I can. So if I'm going to shoot, say, that great shot at dusk of the factory with right. The smoke just pouring out, and we see Biker Joe leaving his shift and getting into his Chevy and driving home, I'll shoot a lot at the golden hour for that look, you know, that aura of dusk coming on. So for me, it's all about the beauty. But Charlie, I found a beauty in her, and I think that a lot of the men did too, because she clearly was the dancer they'd go to see. And I do find, like, Smitty on his Harley riding across the bridge, you know, there's a beauty in that too. So for me, I'm always looking for the best shot.
You know, I grew up in a small town and I got out, you know, that phrase to get out. Like,
right.
What do you think the people now that you've hung out there for a long time and met with all these people, you've hung out with people even without the camera on, like, what do they want? Do they want to get out? Do they want to make their community better? Or do they want something else? What do you think they want?
I don't think most of them want to get out. I think they're really rooted there. And I noticed that when I did live in a rural area, most people are like, God, you're moving to Chicago? Why? Why do you want to live in Chicago? And I'll tell you, my first 2 years back here, I miss living in a rural area all the time. I still do, thinking about, like, the Sandhill Cranes migrating through, all those things that we miss in an urban area. And I think on the river, there's such a lifestyle that I'm sure there are the people that want to get out. But these characters, I think in many ways, they are very rooted there. They're proud to be from there. Their families are from there. And there's this whole sense of history. Like, you hear Smitty talking about, you know, how the captains would come and they'd tie up and then they'd find a lady of the night and this whole history, you know, but he doesn't know much about Huck Finn. But it's really in their blood. It's who they are.
In my hometown, you know, like I said, in Northeast Ohio, the old rundown steel mill town, if you went to very similar bars and similar hangout scenes and similar music, there's, for the men, for the white men, there's a lot of anger. It doesn't matter what the generation is. There's just a lot of anger. But when I watched your film, I was struck by, I didn't see anger. You know, I saw men were stoic, which I'm used to, but they weren't angry. They didn't take opportunities of that camera to vent. Didn't that surprise you?
It could be the people I chose to film, but no, they were not angry at all. In fact, Joe, who wears the Confederate bandana in the beginning of the film, he takes it off midway through filming. And I said, you know, what happened to your bandana? And he said quietly, I'm not here to offend anybody.
Wow.
So I didn't sense this whole, you know, Smitty, everybody in town says he's a millionaire, that he worked every shift he was offered at the plant. It's quite a feat to get him to buy you a drink, but everybody says he's loaded. So I just sensed, you know, he's retired now. He did his time at the plants. He's got 4 motorcycles and a Camaro. He's happy with his life.
I wonder if the difference between some different towns in the Midwest, you know, and in the Great Lake, you know, the Rust Belt area versus down the Mississippi. And what if the difference isn't the people or isn't even what happens? It seems similar problems happen. It's the river. Maybe that metaphor running by you must affect you.
I would think it would. And I'm always, like, Shooter and Whitley, also on this body of water, Green Bay. Part of what I'm interested in is how bodies of water really affect people and our lives. I just think it influences everything. Old Milts, it's a block from the river. It's a river bar. Smitty, he lives right on the river. In some of the shots, you can see the reflection of the river in his front window. When he pulls out on his chopper, he's riding along the river. He has to cross the dam to get into town. Penetrates everything. Every part of their life, really, is this massive amount of water moving by silently, but with total power.
Wow, that is a hell of a metaphor.
Yeah, like Joe says, the trains come through all night long. They may slow down at 1, 2 in the morning, but it's all night. There's just this movement, barges, trains. Everything's moving, but as things are now, they don't need the town. Nobody needs to stop anymore. You just keep on going.
I was born and raised here, and we moved to West Plains about 2 years ago, and we ended up coming back and pretty much waiting until our bus comes, because this town is like falling apart. Everything, life's changed since when I was little. A lot of the buildings are too old to do anything with, so they're tearing them down or they just leave them sitting. There's a lot of empty buildings around. There's a memorial bridge that they had, because the old one they had to take down because it wasn't fixable no more. I think it was in like 1998, maybe. After the flood of 93, everything's wiped out down here. There used to be houses over there on the other side. There ain't none no more, and a lot of people have moved, and there's newer ones. And then my boyfriend and I moved away in 2013, and we come back in June, and pretty much since the end of June have been just, you know, staying where we can until we can get a bus to go to Kurtzville, because that's where we're going to start over. There's jobs down there. They don't have jobs here anymore very much.
That's a clip from Drifting Towards the Crescent, the latest film from documentary filmmaker Laura Stewart, and she was talking with Charles Monroe Kane. That's it for this podcast extra. We'll be back with a full hour soon. And if this conversation got you thinking, you might be interested in hearing how Charles tackled producing a documentary about his own small hometown in Northeast Ohio. It's in our podcast feed. Just look for the episode called Center of the World. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, from the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio, and from these folks.
PRI, Public Radio International.